We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined by Jeff Shepard. He's the author of The Nixon Conspiracy. He also has a website. It's called shepardonwatergate.com. That's Shepard spelled S-H-E-P-A-R-D. So shepardonwatergate.com. The book is The Nixon Conspiracy. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be with you, Emily.
Of course. Now, you actually worked in the Nixon administration. You have an article in The Federalist that caught my attention today. It's entitled, Americans Aren't Getting the Real Watergate Story from John Dean and CNN. Now, the context here is that the 17th of June is the 50th anniversary of the Watergate hearings, happening during the January 6th hearings, which means, of course, the punditocracy is drawing comparisons and parallels and all of that good stuff, trying to juxtapose what we saw back in Watergate with what we're seeing in the January 6th hearings. Jeff, you have a lot of insight on this. You were there. You wrote a book. Why don't you start by telling us what your involvement was with the Nixon administration those 50 years ago?
Sure. Now it seems like just yesterday. I was the youngest lawyer on Nixon's White House staff. I joined the administration 2 weeks out of Harvard Law School, and I stayed 5 years. And I was on a group called the Domestic Council, which was the counterpart of the National Security Council. We staffed the president on domestic initiatives, and it was John Ehrlichman's staff. John figures very prominently in Watergate. My immediate supervisor was Bud Krogh. Bud Krogh figures very prominently in Watergate because he was the head plumber. I worked on the law and order issue. I worked with everybody at the Department of Justice. I knew everybody who was involved in Watergate except the Cuban Americans. And then toward the end, I volunteered and I became deputy counsel to the Watergate defense team. So I worked in the White House the whole time. I served on the defense team. In the course of that, I transcribed the tapes. I ran the document rooms holding the seized files, and I staffed the presidential counselors on the Watergate issue. And as you and your listeners know, it all ended rather badly. President Nixon resigned in disgrace, and 20 members of his administration went to prison. So it was a total wipeout. Now, tomorrow, the 17th of June, is the 50th anniversary of the break-in.
Of the break-in. Okay, not the hearings. The break-in.
Not the hearings.
Got it.
The hearings came later. So what you have is three absolute facts that your listeners can take to the bank. There really was a break-in. So there's no question there was a crime committed. There really was a cover-up. There was an effort to prevent people from knowing how high up the knowledge of the planned break-in went, and Nixon really did resign. But everything else is up for grabs because it became heavily politicized. And we didn't have a diversified press then, so there was a single narrative, and it was the deep state fighting to retain power. And just to juxtapose what's happening today, back then, Nixon had won re-election in a landslide, the biggest electoral victory in our nation's history, taking every state except Massachusetts in the district. So the Democrats had suffered this humongous loss. And you have to understand, they'd controlled everything in the government from the Depression forward, from 1932. So the previous 40 years, it's a Democratic city, a Democratic Congress, and the only non-Democrat was President Eisenhower. He was a military hero. He could have won on behalf of either party. It was his vice president, this Richard Nixon guy, who was the troublemaker. And they had run a progressive, a classic, dyed-in-the-wool progressive named George McGovern. And he actually said, I'm going to raise taxes. If I win, let me promise you, I'm going to raise taxes. And the way we made fun of his campaign was we labeled it acid, amnesty, and abortion. because the kids were all on drugs. The people who had opposed the Vietnam War and burned their draft cards, they wanted amnesty after Nixon stopped the war. And of course, it was abortion on demand. And they lost horrendously. The progressives really lose because the American people aren't there. But during the campaign, somebody got carried away and they broke into the Democratic National Committee headquarters. They planted bugs. The bugs didn't work like they should have. So they went back in on June 17th and they got caught. They got caught red-handed. And it was four Cuban Americans and the head of security for Nixon's reelection campaign, a guy named James McCord. And he was a CIA wireman. He'd been with the agency for 40 years. So the issue then became, who else knew? Who knew this caper was going to go on? And there were two others who masterminded the caper. Gordon Liddy, who was a retired FBI agent and was chief counsel of the committee to reelect, and Howard Hunt, who was a career CIA officer. And it was Howard who got the Cubans because he had helped train them for the Bay of Pigs invasion. And he was the mysterious Eduardo who they looked up to while they preparing to invade Cuba. So when he said, look, national security is at risk, we need your help doing this break-in, they did it. They just got caught. Well, the difficulty was there were other people. The knowledge of the camp of the proposed break-in went up much further in the re-election campaign. So there was a cover-up. The cover-up was run by the president's own lawyer, a man by the name of John Dean. And he first told the White House, when these guys were arrested, the White House people didn't know about the plan to break in. They didn't know about the campaign intelligence plan. And they were clean. And they said to Dean, anybody here on the White House involved? And Dean said, no, the White House is clean. Now, it was only a partial truth because Dean knew about the plans. He'd recruited Liddy for the job. Now, Dean will sue you if you say he knew about the planned break-in. He knew they were proposing to bug the other side, but he maintains he didn't know that was the day they were going in or where they were going to hit. I wouldn't know. May or may not be true. But to John Dean's mind, there was no difference between the White House proper and the committee to reelect the president, which was in the office building across the street at 1701 Pennsylvania Avenue. To those of us on the White House staff, it was a huge difference because the White House was clean. The campaign committee was not clean at all. There were gonna be people going to jail. So John ran this cover up and he sat in on all the interviews and he got all the documents from the FBI and he passed them around and he helped people prepare to be questioned. And the effort at the end was to get all the burglars who were indicted, get them to plead guilty so there wouldn't be a trial. But two of them didn't, Gordon Liddy and James McCord. They got convicted. The judge sent sentencing 2 months away. So they're convicted on January 30th. Sentencing is March 21st. And these people are looking at long prison terms because the judge is known as Maximum John Sirica, and he's used to throwing the book at people. One of the people, James McCord, who was the CIA guy, he wrote the judge a letter. And he said, look, they've been lying to you. People have perjured themselves. They're trying to avoid fault. And Sirica opened the letter on sentencing day, read it, dramatic as can be. And then the people who were running the cover-up, McCord didn't know very much, but the people who were running the cover-up panicked because they thought the whole house of cards was going to come down. And of course it was, but it was going to come down on the campaign people. But Dean, who's a White House person, and he's been masterminding it, he's described by the FBI as the master manipulator of the cover-up. He runs to the prosecutors and says, I can tell you about this cover-up, but you got to let me go. I got to get immunity. And the more he tells them, these are career prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office, the more he tells them, the more concerned they are that he's downplaying his own role. He's minimizing his own role. And in the end, I'm almost through, and forgive me, Emily.
Oh, no, this is fascinating.
In the end, they decide not to give him immunity. He's too involved. So he's hired a very prominent Democrat as his lawyer. The Democrat approaches the Senate Irvin Committee, which is looking for dramatic witnesses. And he says, listen, if you give John Dean immunity, he'll accuse Nixon and his boss, Bob Haldeman, and the other top lawyer, John Ehrlichman, of being in on the cover-up. He will tell the people that there was a conspiracy and they were all part of it. Hmm. And he did that. And the Irvin Committee, not unlike the January 6th committee today, is looking for drama. This kid is going to supply it, you know, this young, earnest lawyer. So they cast him as a hero. Now, that's very frustrating for people who know what really happened, because as John Dean says in his conversation with Nixon, this all started when Bob Haldeman asked me to pull together a perfectly legitimate campaign intelligence plan, and I recruited Gordon Liddy. Well, if you knew Gordon, you shouldn't have done that, because Gordon got carried away. Now, Emily, we've noticed recently that the other side can get carried away in campaigning and can set up Russian hoaxes and other things, very elaborate schemes. So we shouldn't be too harsh on the campaign people getting carried away. They should have gone to jail. But what happened was the other side took that and blew it, politicized it, blew it way out of proportion. So the cover-up became more important than the crime. And John Dean was willing to say, in order to get immunity and in order to become a nationwide hero, that yes, there was a cover-up, he was involved, but so was everybody else.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows, you can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bedsheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794 8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist.
Now, I'm a lawyer. I've studied this stuff. I lived through it. I've done a lot of research. The law of conspiracy, and particularly conspiracy to obstruct justice, is what's known as a thought crime. The jury is asked to look into your mind and decide what you were thinking when you did it. Not so much what you did, it's what we think you were thinking. And if they don't like you, say you're from the opposite political party and you've been torn apart for 2.5 years in the press, it's very easy for them to decide you had evil intent. And one of the great things, there's this great lawyer from before you were born named Clarence Darrow. And Clarence Darrow once said, if you would worry about your own civil rights, you should become familiar with the law of conspiracy. Because once a conspiracy has been shown to exist, it takes virtually no evidence to add a new participant. And there's this paragraph from this case out in California where they say, you know, a conspiracy can go on for a long time. There doesn't have to be a given meeting. Everybody doesn't have to know each other. People can come and go in the course of the conspiracy. Well, here's John Dean sitting on immunity saying, yes, and we're all in on it. And of course, what the Irvin Committee wanted to do was dump on Nixon and dump on Nixon's people. And it became so politicized that the Department of the new Attorney General agreed to an independent prosecutor who wouldn't be supervised by the Department of Justice, Archie Cox. It was his Harvard Law professor. And Archie came down and he hired 100 people, specially recruited. So you had this anti-Nixon group of people, mainly from Ivy League colleges and law schools, whose goal was to get Nixon. And they announced at their first press conference they would investigate every single thing Nixon had done since taking office. So you had something like a legal pogrom going on. And then you had their star witness was John Dean. He'd recruited Gordon Liddy. He'd been to meetings where it was discussed. He was the master manipulator of the cover-up. For Dean to be treated as a whistleblowing hero is something like the kid who murders his parents and then throws himself on the mercy of the court because he's an orphan. I mean, this guy was the centerpiece of Watergate from day one. But he's cast, in order to get to Nixon, he's cast as a hero. Now, we're going to stop there for just a second. Because I'm gonna jump forward almost 40 years. Okay. You've had a total wipeout. Nixon's resigned in disgrace. 20 of my friends go to jail. Some should. Some should have gone to jail. Some of them weren't my friends, but 20 people from the Nixon administration. Well, turns out this special prosecution force, they were so eager to convict Nixon and his top associates, sometimes on weak evidence, that they started cutting corners.
This is what I was going to ask you about.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you.
Yeah.
And you don't know what the bigger surprise is, that they did unethical things, lots of them, or that they recorded memos and left a paper trail of their unethical acts. And over the past 8 years, starting in 2013, these memos and documents started to surface.
Right.
And they surfaced mainly at the National Archives, but some surfaced back at Harvard Law School because one of the people took his records back and gave them to the law school. And in each of these four instances, I've been the first person to view these documents. And that's a benefit because, see, I lived through it. Mm-hmm. So I can connect all the dots. Other people, they wouldn't understand the significance of this memo or that memo.
You have the context.
So I got the context. Let me tell you, it's in scar tissue up and down my backside. So what I concluded, this is astonishing, Emily. the three branches of government, or the representatives of the three branches, the legislative, the judicial, and the executive, secretly linked arms with a complacent press, only presenting one point of view, to drive Nixon from office and cripple the Republican Party. And your visitors can say, I mean, your doubters can say, well, you know, that's just not true. Who are you talking about? But you see, I've got the documents. Mm-hmm. And the documents show there were at least a dozen secret meetings with the trial judge, right, where they worked out issues in advance. And the documents show that the chief counsel of the Senate Irvin Committee, who taught at Georgetown Law School, where Judge Sirica taught, they were buddies. And Sam Dash came down to talk to Sirica secretly to discuss how things were going. And it wasn't just once. He came a number of times. He wrote a book, Sam Dash, the chief counsel. And he said, you know, the hearing went very smoothly because I prepared all the questions for people to use. And John Dean's testimony was so startling and so dramatic because I went out to his house and helped him to write it. Mm. And we set it up so he'd come on as a witness in the middle of the afternoon. We let him read his entire 240-page statement, and he ended his statement at the moment we adjourned the hearing, so there was no cross-examination. Everybody went home with John Dean's unchallenged testimony ringing in their ears. And wasn't it great that we could portray John Dean as a hero? And of course, to the people on the White House staff, he's not a hero at all. So we've covered the executive branch where the prosecutor's meeting with a judge. We've covered the legislative branch where the chief counsel meeting with a judge. And we get the judge meeting with all these people that he shouldn't meet with. If this stuff came out during the trials or shortly thereafter, the verdicts would have had to been vacated. Mm-hmm. But it's been 50 years. Well, almost 50 years. So what do we do? Well, it turns out, and this is kind of exciting, this is the good news. It took 40 years to come out, 45 years. But the Department of Justice has this internal affairs unit set up after Watergate, whose only mission in life is to respond and investigate to allegations of misconduct by Department of Justice attorneys. See, federal prosecutors have so much latitude and so much power that the attorney general said, somebody's got to watch these people, because it's not win at all costs. There are rules. There are rules we follow to be sure people get a fair trial. And they set up this organization called the Office of Professional Responsibility. Now, I'm a little late to the game. I learned about it last October. It was a Sunday, October 3rd.
And this is when you filed.
And I filed immediately.
That's right.
An electronic filing. And I got a response back. And in their website, they're so sincere. Only career attorneys. You put in an allegation, we will take it seriously. We will launch a full, thorough investigation. We will give you a written report. Don't expect to hear back for 8 to 10 weeks, because, I mean, we're going to take this seriously. So I get an electronic response back saying, got it, investigation underway, don't call us, we'll call you. Hmm. And then because the electronic form was somewhat limiting, I've started sending them follow-up letters, and I've sent 9 so far. Another one's going to go off on Monday. Saying, look, I want to come down. I want to explain this. It's terribly complex. But let me just take this one little thing and tell you how bad it is what they did. Every one of those letters is posted on my website. Hmm. Because it's not a secret. The Department of Justice won't talk. But I can say, look, here's what I've done. Here's what I've tipped them off to. Come read my letters. So this could be really exciting. Because I don't think they can just blow this off. They can't say, look, it was a long time ago. Because I have said in my follow-up letter, this stuff was hidden for 40 years. We've only started to discover these memos in the past 8 years. And they'll say, well, you know, Archie Cox, Lynn Jaworski, they're all dead. Mm-hmm. And I say, no, no, no. Ah, contraire. When the special prosecution team from 50 years ago decided they thought Trump ought to be impeached, they wrote a newspaper column. 17 of them signed the article, and they told all the great things they'd accomplished since they were special prosecutors. So we know they were around.
Right.
And some of these memos mention particular prosecutors, and we know some of those people are around. Mm-hmm. So let's talk to these people. Let's talk about whether these things happened or not. And I'll just finish up with one quote, because quotes are so much fun. John Adams, our second president, was a lawyer out of Boston. After the Tea Party, where the Boston Massacre, British soldiers shot an American, and they were going to be prosecuted, as they should have been, and they couldn't get an attorney. Nobody would represent them because they were the hated Brits. And John Adams said, they deserve a fair defense. I will defend them. And he says during the course of the trial, you know, their public passions are all over the place, but facts are stubborn things. Mm. And I quote that today. He got them off, by the way, but I've got these memos, and the memos won't go away. The memos say we sat alone, Lynn Jaworski. We talked as we sat alone in the jury room, and here's what Sirica wanted, and here's what I wanted. And then there's a second memo, and he says, on the day the indictments were handed down, I slipped into his chambers, and we rehearsed what we would do so he could name himself to preside over the trial.
That's referencing Sirica.
I'll say this, you say that, I'll say this. Just unbelievable. You're supposed to get a judge who is fair and impartial. We got a judge who may as well have sat at the prosecution team.
Cancel culture is coming to your bank, and holding the wrong political views might soon leave you out in the cold. I'm Bill Walton. On the latest episode of The Bill Walton Show, Todd Zwicky, Paul Watkins, and I discuss what is already happening, how the Biden administration is already pursuing this agenda, and what we can do about it. This progressive culture offensive is relentless. It's coming for you, and you won't hear about this anywhere else. Follow The Bill Walton Show at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
How is it possible that they got away at the time with having 24 meetings with the trial judge and no media attention? Republicans didn't pick up on it and make it public. How did all of that happen in secret at the time?
Well, because it happened in secret, because nobody knew.
How did they manage to keep that?
And these records, of course, were taken, so you couldn't see the records for 40 years. Mm-hmm. It didn't have the modern communications that we have today. Mm-hmm. And the press was of a single mind.
That's an important point.
That's the biggest difference between then and now. What you had to say didn't fit in with a narrative. This is a new word. We didn't use this word before. We didn't use deep state. We didn't use fake news. We didn't use narrative. But the narrative was they're all crooks in the Nixon White House. So anything we can do to further that, it's fair game. Anything that gets in the way isn't fair game. And I'll give you three quick examples because it's kind of fun. Deep Throat. Deep Throat was the source for Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein in describing what was going on and what was happening with the Watergate investigation. For 30 years, we were led to believe that Deep Throat was somebody on Nixon's White House staff who was so disgusted with criminality that they leaked the stuff to Bob Woodward. Turns out, totally wrong. The leaks were coming from the deputy director of the FBI who wanted to be named director, and he was trying to show the acting director was incompetent. Now, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein have known this for 30 years, not a word, because they wanted the public to believe it got to be Nixon's Nixon's person. The thing that drove Nixon out of office at the end was a tape recording called The Smoking Gun.
Right.
It was June 23rd, 1972, shortly after the break-in. And Bob Haldeman comes in and says, the FBI wants to interview these two people, and we don't want them to, because it will lead to disclosure of names of prominent Democrats who've given money to our campaign. And what John Dean thinks we ought to do to prevent this is get the CIA to tell the FBI not to interview these two people. It's very clear on the tape. That's what's going on. Well, when the lawyers heard that tape way, way, way at the end of the unfolding of the scandal, Nixon's defense team, they misunderstood. They thought the effort was to shut down the entire FBI investigation, which really is a obstruction of justice. So the lawyers demanded that this tape be made public right away. And it was. And Nixon resigned 3 days later. So this burst the dam, and all of his support, whatever there was that was left, disappeared. Right. Now, John Dean knew for the next 40 years that that wasn't the reason for getting the CIA to tell the FBI not to. And he gets around to saying that in a book he publishes in 2014. No, it happens to be at page 55. He says, you know, it's the funniest thing. That's been misunderstood for the whole, ever since. Nixon's lawyers didn't get it. And when the feds looked into it, these guys, their interviews were only postponed 10 days. These guys weren't involved, and there were no charges. And he says at the end, you know, and this is a quote, if Nixon's lawyers had known, Nixon might have lived to fight again another day. In short, the smoking gun was shooting blanks. So here's this guy.
That's from John Dean.
That's from John Dean's own pen 40 years later.
Page 55.
Now, he knew all along. Now, I figured it out before his book, but why should I carry the burden? He says it. But he didn't say it at the trial. Here's Bob Haldeman being prosecuted. His life is hanging by a thread. His liberty is hanging by a thread. He knows John Dean told him to do this to protect these two names. John Dean has sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help him God. And he doesn't do it. They're saying, well, now this conversation, you know, wasn't it all about politics? And John says, well, they were worried about Gordon Liddy being involved, which was just, it was fog. It was squid ink. He didn't tell the whole truth. That comes out. And then finally, and I'll stop because I get to be preachy, the Nixon staff people didn't get a fair trial. There were all kinds of violations of due process because they were prosecuted. But they decided not to prosecute Nixon. They decided to help the House Judiciary Committee to impeach him. And they'd gathered all of this evidence for criminal prosecutions. That's what a grand jury's for. But they wanted to transfer the evidence up to the Congress. Never been done before, really an open question of whether you could do it at all. So they hit upon this cute trick to send it up under seal, because it was grand jury material, and they called this report the roadmap, because the roadmap would lead to Nixon's impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
And it stayed sealed. Nixon resigns, Nixon's pardoned, life goes on. And it wasn't unsealed until 2018 as a result of my court petition. So for the first time, Nixon's defense team can learn of the specific charges made against Richard Nixon. Because we didn't know.
Right.
We didn't know what they said to the grand jury. We didn't know what they said to the House Judiciary Committee. But I'll tell you what happened. Now I can put these pieces together, and this is really interesting. In that era, if you were going to avoid a massive election victory, you needed a crime, a personal crime committed by the president, the equivalent of bribery or treason. That's mentioned in the Constitution. And the special prosecutor said, we got it. We got him cold. Don't you worry your pretty little head about that. None of this conspiracy stuff. We can prove Nixon personally approved the payment of blackmail to Howard Hunt. We can tell you when he did it. It's all on tape. Okay? So here's what happens. On Wednesday, March 21st, John Dean goes in to see the president and gives what's called the cancer on the presidency speech. It's pretty clear tape. I transcribed it. I know it. He says, look, I've asked for the meeting because you're going to be making decisions and they're pretty significant and you don't know what's been going on, but people have been perjuring themselves. There's been a cover up and we're being blackmailed and we aren't quite sure what to do. And, you know, we kind of like to know what you want to do. And that's when he says it all started with this campaign intelligence plan. And they chat for an hour and a half. It's not Nixon's noblest moment because like any good lawyer, he tests every possible answer. These are his own people. This is real trouble. The guy's going to spill the beans on other stuff and they don't want him to. What are we going to do? Should we pay him? Should we buy time? They don't say let a contract, but you know what? How are we going to respond? And we have the whole tape. And the answer is we need to get John Mitchell down here tomorrow, huddle, and figure out what to do. So Haldeman calls Mitchell. Meeting ends at noon. Haldeman calls Mitchell, says, you need to come down. We need to talk. Mitchell says, okay, I can't get down today. I'll come down tomorrow. But what's so odd? Oh, and then Mitchell and the paymaster, a guy named Fred LaRue, who made payments to people, already paid out $350,000. Mitchell and LaRue talk. LaRue says, look, he wants money. Mitchell says, what's it for? And LaRue says, legal bills. So Mitchell says, well, I guess if it were me, I was not, but if it were me, I'd probably pay it. So that very night, a payment of $70,000 is made to Howard Hunt's lawyer. So look at it from the prosecutors. They want to bag Nixon. They want to bag him good. He learns that a meeting ends at 12 o'clock. 10 o'clock that night, the payment's made. Speaks for itself. He must have approved the payment. All that had to happen, I hold up my hand here, there we go, is he learns about the demand. He tells Haldeman to call Mitchell, to call LaRue, to make the payment.
Right.
Okay, a chain of events that fits within the 10-hour window. Now, they had it. I mean, they were doing high fives, cartwheels down the hallway. They had Nixon cold. Except they couldn't prove when Mitchell talked to LaRue. They both had testified in front of the grand jury that they had talked, but they didn't know when. And they couldn't find long distance information. They couldn't find anything. So they made it up. They said he had to have talked in the early afternoon because that fit their scenario. And they told the grand jury that. They named Nixon the co-conspirator. They told the House Judiciary Committee that in secret. And they recommended Nixon's impeachment. We have a paper trail that does this. But when the roadmap got unsealed in 2018, I went back and I was working through it. And the part where they say in or about the early afternoon of Wednesday, March 21st, Mitchell and LaRue spoke, there's no proof of that. They cite grand jury testimony, but there's no proof.
Hmm.
They don't even ask about the timing of the call because I suspect they knew LaRue had a different story. LaRue said, John Dean told me that morning of his demand for money. I said, I won't pay without permission. He said, why don't you call Mitchell? So when Dean went off to his meeting with the president, I called Mitchell. And if Mitchell okayed the payment, before the meeting with the president even broke up, Nixon can't have approved the payment. Now, remember, it's circumstantial to begin with, because neither Nixon nor Haldeman nor Mitchell are willing to say, oh, Nixon told us to do it. That's gone. That's not there at all. But the prosecutors say, well, you can't trust them anyway. You know, they're Nixon people. But LaRue says, look, I'm not positive, but to the best of my recollection, that call occurred in the morning. Well, they just skip it. All their written material presented to the grand jury, presented to the House Judiciary Committee, finesses that. Okay? But in the cover-up trial, when they put LaRue on the stand, he says, best of my knowledge, it occurred in the morning. And they're flabbergasted because they've gotten rid of Nixon based on the other representation. It's in secret. So they said, well, you sure you didn't call him, but you didn't reach him, and he called back in the afternoon. And LaRue says, possible, but I don't think so. That's not the way I remember it. I remember I called him in the morning. Now, if everything had been known, if we had known that was the accusation, that would have been the end of the case against Nixon right there. But we didn't even know the accusation was made. So until the roadmap was unsealed, we couldn't have known what they accused Nixon of doing. That's what my book is about. We started out talking about my book.
Yes.
Let's go back to my book. I want you to read my book. You got to work on it. The Nixon Conspiracy. It's complex because Watergate's complex. But it's there. And if you go on the website, shepherdonwatergate.com, all of the documents I cite, all of these documents that I've uncovered, links are posted on the website. So it's not trust me. It's look, here's the documents.
Right. When did you first start picking up that there was a paper trail that told a different story? Was it at the time or was it, you know?
No.
Decades later.
2003. I decided that somebody had to tell our side of the story. I wanted to write it all by myself. I didn't want to consult with anybody else. And when I was, you know, me and Watergate, when I was through, there were just a couple facts I needed to double check, dates or something. And so I made arrangements to go down to the archives who had all the files. And I learned, much to my surprise, the special prosecutors were government employees. All their files that survived are kept at National Archives. Now, they're not kept out at the Nixon Library. That's stuff from the Nixon White House. This is kept at what's called Archives 2 in College Park, Maryland. Well, this is like discovering 30 years later that you can get the playbook from the coach whose team beat you in the state finals. You know what you were trying to do. You know what your strengths were, what the plays were going to be and everything. Now you can see their side of the story. And that's when it all starts to come together. They weren't playing fair. They were meeting secretly with a judge. They were suppressing evidence that would have helped the defendants. Clear and convincing evidence that would have helped. They were indicting Republicans on weak evidence and taking a bye on Democrats who were guilty as all get out. It was a political prosecution from the outset. And I mean, I started looking at their records, but then these four batches of documents became available. Leon Jaworski's, he was a special prosecutor, 2013. James Vorenberg, who was the Harvard criminal professor, who took notes at every staff meeting. He took the notes back to Harvard with him. And then Phil Lacovara, it's not a public name, but he was counsel to the special prosecutor. He took boxes with him when he left, and he turned them back to archives in 2020. And then, of course, I got the roadmap unsealed. So I've been a busy boy. and it's, I mean, I really do love to do research. It's really kind of fun. You research your family, you research the history of your house, that kind of stuff. Well, I'm researching Watergate. You know, and there's stuff there. And I this sounds like braggadocio, and maybe it is. I don't think there's another person alive who would recognize the importance when I go through all these documents. And you go down to the National Archives, and they'll let you scan the documents. So you make a decision. You're looking through Jeb Magruder's file, and here's a document. And you make a decision, do I scan it or not? And it takes about a half a minute to scan each page. So you can read about a third of the next page while it's scanning. And you really, there's no time to study the document. You go do that at home. So you scan during a usual stop, about 400 pages. You go home, you put them in order, you staple the right memos together, because the files aren't necessarily in order. The archives will not straighten out a file. They keep it just like they got it. And then you highlight the dates, and you try to put it in order, and you try to make sense. And slowly, this mosaic comes in, and you're saying, good heavens, look at what they did. Now, if I could, let me switch to today. Okay? Remember, I said they're all three branches of the government secretly linked arms to drive Nixon from office to void his election. It's the opposite today. They're terrified of the election that's coming. And the only thing they have to throw sand in the gears to a massive Republican victory is this J6 committee. Hmm. Now, it's in the House. It's not in the Senate. But they're going about the same approach. They're conducting a legislative trial. Congress isn't supposed to do that. They're supposed to gather information to pass legislation, or they're supposed to oversee executive functions. But these people are saying, we can flush out information, get it public, because, boy, we got to have it public now, and then give it to the Department of Justice. This is backwards. The Department of Justice is supposed to conduct the criminal investigations. They do it in secret. You have rights. Now, you don't have rights in front of the grand jury. That's done in secret. And it's a terror if you are subject. I've never been in front of a grand jury, but it's like the Star Chamber. You don't get a lawyer. You don't know who's been there before. You don't get to put on your own witnesses. You don't get to cross-examine anybody. Nobody presents the case against you. But the grand jury is limited in its function. It can only decide if there's probable cause to believe a crime has been committed. Then, if you go to prove that in a court of law, the Fifth and Sixth Amendments come into effect. Public trial. Government has to put on their case first through sworn testimony of witnesses subject to cross-examination. None of this whispering stuff. You have the right to put on witnesses. The government's got to put on its whole case before you have to decide, am I going to take the stand or not take the stand? You get to put on your own evidence, your own witnesses, in front of a fair and impartial judge, a jury of your peers, who must unanimously agree that you're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So the whole burden when you go to a trial switches where the defendant has rights. And it's not that the Fifth and Sixth Amendments weren't written to protect the college football captain or the homecoming queen. It's to protect the downtrodden, to protect the people that society is rejecting, the outcasts. And let me assure you, Nixon's people were outcasts. But most Americans, if they think about it, and they may chant, lock her up, but if they think about it, they think no matter how heinous the crime, no matter how despicable the defendant, they get a fair trial. Okay? That's the rule of law. Then we hang you, but you get a fair trial beforehand. But you see, in Watergate, they didn't get a fair trial. The prosecutors cheated. The prosecutors cut all these corners. They met secretly with a judge. They suppressed exculpatory evidence. And you sit there and you go through it and you say, good heavenly days. So I've got these complaints pending before the Department of Justice. There's an organization that is something of your namesake called the Federalist Society.
Right.
Conservative lawyers might be interested to know about these documents. They've agreed to host a symposium in September on troublesome documents from the Watergate prosecutions. And we have judges, we have law professors, and we have prominent practitioners lined up to discuss my documents. So I say, here's the document, here's what I think, but you know, who am I? And then they're going to talk about it. And that should really be interesting. I mean, I'm biased. I lived through it. I saw my friends go to jail. But this is going to be really senior people talking about what these documents mean. And I very, very much look forward to it.
Likewise, and we'll continue to follow the case. This has been fascinating perspective and research. Thank you so much, Jeff Shepard.
Thank you for having me on, Emily. Talk to you again.
Of course, absolutely. So you can go to Jeff's website. It is shepardonwatergate.com. So that's S-H-E-P-A-R-D on watergate.com. His book is called The Nixon Conspiracy. You can learn and see for yourself all of these documents on the site, and you can read the book. And we certainly recommend you take a look at those. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.